This is State of the Union, the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is the city's largest union of municipal employees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sunday evenings at 8 p.m. and then we rebroadcast again on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. You can reach us at State of the Union at dc37.net. You can follow us on Twitter, and you can friend us on Facebook. And we've got a good show this evening. We've got, later on in the show, we're going to have the First Lady of the City of New York, Shirlane McRae. She's going to be talking about a new initiative, actually a continuation of an initiative fighting opioid abuse. But our first guest this evening is the nation's national affairs correspondent, John Nichols. He is the associate editor of the Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin. Welcome to the show, Mr. Nichols.
Sir, it is a pleasure to be with you.
I saw the piece that you wrote recently on the nomination of Neil Gorsuch, who is Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court. I want to take us back just a little bit on the importance of this nomination. And you raised some very provocative points about whether or not he has disqualified himself from being a nominee for the Supreme Court. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the argument I made was somewhat separate from the very good arguments that thinking trade unionists and environmentalists and advocates for civil rights and civil liberties have made against the Gorsuch nomination. I don't diminish any of those arguments. I think they're very important, and I tend to agree with them. But the point I was getting to goes deeper to the very concept of an independent judiciary. Our founders gave us three branches of government, equal branches, executive, legislative, and judicial. The judicial branch is to be the ultimate check and balance on the power of the executive and on the excesses of the legislative. And I might add, at this point, I think we're seeing a lot of evidence of why you need a check and balance. If the judicial branch is corrupted, if it is diminished, if it is undermined by politics and unreasonable politics, that's a danger not just to the judicial branch, but to the whole of the American experiment. Neil Gorsuch has been nominated for the United States Supreme Court for an opening on that court, not via a traditional route, but because of a corruption of the process. President Obama nominated a qualified, actually very moderate jurist, Merrick Garland, to fill the opening on the court that was created by the death of Antonin Scalia more than a year ago. And that nomination was stopped in its tracks. It was not considered. It was not given a hearing. It was not given any votes. It was killed by partisan Republicans in the Senate who simply wanted to keep the seat open for whoever the next president they were hoping a Republican president would pick. Donald Trump, as a candidate for president, supported that corruption of the process. When he became president, he appointed Neil Gorsuch. If Neil Gorsuch was an honorable man, if he was a serious adherent to the basic concepts of the rule of law and how we organize the judiciary in this country, he would have refused that nomination. And he would have said, no, this seat belongs to Merrick Garland. He said, you should renominate Merrick Garland. Gorsuch didn't do that. He is a hyperpartisan political player, deeply rooted in Republican politics, deeply rooted in the conservative movement. He took that nomination. When he went before the Senate, he was given an opportunity by Patrick Leahy and again by Al Franken to, at the very least, at the very minimum, acknowledge the damage to the process done by the way in which he got his nomination, to talk about it, to say this can't continue, this can't be the future, or we will have a fully politicized process by which justices go to the high court. He refused to do that. He played games with the question. He danced around it in the most sly and spin-worthy or spin-type approaches. And as such, I will argue, he disqualified himself as a nominee for the United States Supreme Court. He should be opposed by Democrats and, frankly, by Republicans who actually care even in the least about the future of the courts.
And let's be clear about, you know, this came up during the campaign. There is now the appointments that are about to happen over the next few years. I mean, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 83 years old. There is this opening now. I mean, this is a court that we're going to have to live with. Gorsuch, if he gets this seat, is a young man. This is a court that we have to live with for 40 years.
Without a doubt. This is a very young man, a very healthy man. But also, more importantly, somebody who arrives at the court steeped in a politics and steeped in an ideology. He is considered a reliable choice by the far right. Research into his rulings as a member of the Circuit Court of Appeals indicates that he stands to the right of Antonin Scalia. He is not a replacement for Antonin Scalia. He is more conservative, less freewheeling and open in his approach to issues. He is more parallel to Clarence Thomas, the most rigid member of the current court. And putting him on that court locks in one seat that will not be held, and I want to emphasize this, that will not be held by what some people might think of as a traditional conservative. That's not how Gorsuch has positioned himself, certainly not in these hearings. Every indication, every answer to questions was that of a politician, of a political player seeking to advance his career. And people should be very, very cautious about that. You can have conservative jurists. You can have liberal jurists. Labor folks will be conscious of the fact that in history, we have sometimes had conservative jurists who respected that right to assemble so much that they honored the right to collective bargaining, to organize a union, because they said, you know, that's rooted in our Constitution. We've had liberals who haven't always been as good on labor.
Right.
So this isn't about liberal conservative. This is about politics. And Neil Gorsuch, by his answers in the hearing and by his approach to this nomination, has shown himself to be someone steeped in politics rather than an understanding of the Constitution or the law.
This is State of the Union, the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. We're talking with John Nichols, who's the associate editor of the Capital Times in Wisconsin and a political contributor, regular contributor to The Nation magazine. The Supreme Court means a lot to everybody in labor these days because of the cases that are coming before it. Right now, there is the possibility of a national right to work, and there are cases coming before the court. There have been two cases recently. There's a third one that will probably wind up before the Supreme Court. The only reason why the last case that was brought before the Supreme Court about public employees was favorably disposed of by the court was because Antonin Scalia died, and that was the Friedrichs case. So there is a lot at stake. You, sir, were in Wisconsin, are in Wisconsin, when Scott Walker first made his attack on public employees in that state, where the labor movement was, some say the labor movement was born, right, in Wisconsin?
Well, certainly your union, absolutely,
and
was born in Wisconsin. There's no doubt of that.
And public employees have had their rights decimated in your state, correct?
Brutally, brutally. There's simply no question of that. And this is, you're getting to the heart of the matter here. Working folks should be deeply concerned about Supreme Court nominations. They should be concerned out of a sense of solidarity with folks who are threatened, whose civil rights and civil liberties are threatened, people of color, immigrants, refugees, members of the LGBTQ community, women, all face threats with a transformation of the court into a political and politicized right-wing entity. But as working people, in and of them, themselves, as working people, they should have a personal concern as regards the courts. The fact of the matter is that decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court in the next 3 or 4 years will define whether unions can be as strong as they have been in the past and as they must be, or whether they will be severely weakened structurally by barriers placed in the way of organizing, of collective bargaining, and of exercising their voices in the political sphere. And I want to emphasize to you, the courts, the Supreme Court especially, for decades have been tipped toward corporate power. They have erred again and again on behalf of corporations. They have been, even in eras when we thought the courts were a little bit better, they have tended to err against trade unionism, against the rights of workers. And now, if you put, if you establish a court that is clearly political, that sees the political advantage for the Republican Party, for lack of a better term, in weakening unions, the dangers become exponentially greater. It's no longer a game of weakening or undermining unions. It really is a game of trying to destroy their ability to function. No court, no politician will ever end the trade union movement. It is stronger and more important and more vital and more necessary. And even if it's undermined, the trade union movement will continue and it will have victories. But I cannot emphasize to you how many barriers will be put in the way of what should be the simple work of organizing and collective bargaining by a court that is politicized. And that's why this nomination is a big, big deal.
Let's be clear about the fact that the last 30 years, as unions have been attacked, as the number of union members has decreased in the private sector, this wage stagnation, this income inequality that we talk about all the time, that is affected by the deunionization of the country for all workers. It's not just a matter of fewer people have the right to be in a union, and that just affects them. It affects all workers because unions raise the wages and the benefits and the working conditions for all workers. Just talk about that a little bit, if you will.
Well, you say it well, and I can only build on the wise point that you make. Look, the reason we have a minimum wage is not merely for minimum wage workers. We have a minimum wage in this country because you establish a floor and then you build up from it. Well, it's the same with trade unions. Trade unions are obviously vital in the workplace where they represent workers. But trade unions are also vital in workplaces where workers aren't represented by, you know, some AFSCME local or some UAW local. Years ago, I was good friends with a guy named William Whippesinger, who was the longtime head of the Machinist Union. And it's very funny. He used to say that his biggest triumph for a good period of time was Delta Airlines. And I would say to him, well, you know, Wimpy, Delta's not organized. I mean, it's not a union. You know, the union isn't there for where the machinists work in those areas. And he said, I know. And they always pay a little more and give a little more in benefits to keep the union out. Right?
Listen, John, I knew this was going to go by very quickly. I hope you come back and do this again. We're talking with John Nichols. He is the associate editor of the Capital Times in Wisconsin, the author of 7 books, and a regular contributor to The Nation magazine. John, thank you very much for being here today.
Honored to be with you and honored to be with the folks from DC 37.
We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union, the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. We're on Sunday evenings at 8 p.m. and we rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. Earlier this month, Mayor Bill de Blasio and First Lady Shalane McRae launched Healing New York City, NYC, a new comprehensive effort to reduce opioid overdose deaths by 35% over the next 5 years. In 2016, more than 1,000 people in New York City died in a drug overdose which involved an opioid, the highest year on record. More New Yorkers died from opioid overdoses last year than from car accidents and homicides combined. Joining us now to talk about Healing NYC, First Lady of New York, Shalane McRae. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's great to be back, Chris. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Let's talk about Healing NYC. Let's talk about the opioid problem. Let's talk about the scope of the problem.
Yeah, it's a really a deadly epidemic, and as you said, it is killing so many of our citizens, so many of our friends and family members in the city, and it's really the advent of fentanyl that's being mixed with the heroin that has made the problem worse for us. So this program, Healing NYC, it's a new phase of the efforts that are already underway in New York City. You know, we've been tackling the problem, but because of fentanyl, we see that we have to do more because we're not going to get at the problem using the same tactics that we've been using.
And when you talk about fentanyl, you're talking about the potency of that particular drug and why, and the dangers of that particular drug and the fact that it is now mixed into the heroin as part of the distribution of heroin?
That's correct. That's right. It's so much stronger than the heroin that's been on the streets. Fentanyl, it's not a new drug. It's similar to morphine, but it's a 50 to 100 times more potent than morphine. So...
Wow.
Yes, exactly. And so it takes a very small amount mixed with heroin to cause an overdose. And people don't know. They don't know what's in the drugs that they're getting. They have no idea.
What can even be worse, I used to work for a program called Phoenix House, which is
yes.
a substance abuse treatment program, and I was a communications director there. And one of the things that happened when I remember back in the day, there was fentanyl mixed in and folks who were strung out on heroin were looking for it because they thought they could manage that drug and they thought that the high would be terrific. So it was this mm-hmm. weird kind of counterintuitive thing where people were told this drug is very powerful,
yes.
but people thought they were so strung out, they thought, well, I could use it. I could use just the right amount. And then, of course, the dangers of that become apparent with the
That's
overdoses.
Right. Yeah, no, it's just devastating.
You can't do any one thing, right? This has to be a multi-prong approach to the problem. And I'm just, if you could tell us a little bit about what the different components of this are. We're talking about prevention
mm-hmm.
and treatment. So what are some of the aspects or the components of Healing NYC?
Well, of course, what's not new about what's going on is the disease that is at the root of this crisis, and that is addiction. So Healing NYC builds on Thrive NYC's, the mental health reform plan for the city, builds on our efforts to address the root causes of addiction and also expand access to the life-saving medications that we're providing, like naloxone or buprenorphine. Naloxone can stop an overdose, and overdose is caused by lack of oxygen, and it actually can reverse someone who's spiraling into death because they can't breathe. And buprenorphine has the power to stop the cravings and reduce the withdrawal symptoms that people feel when they stop using. And we want to expand the availability of naloxone. We're actually distributing 100,000 kits to community-based organizations, and people can find out how to get a naloxone kit by calling 1-888-NYC-WELL, or they can go to any of the 750 participating pharmacies and buy naloxone without a prescription. And if they have insurance, their insurance plan will probably cover some of the cost.
Now, is this at all connected to, and forgive my ignorance on this, but is this at all connected to prescription drugs, or are these totally illicit drugs that are being sold on the streets, this opioid problem?
Well, it's a mix. I mean, a lot of the problem began because we had so many people who were using opioids for legitimate purposes, to reduce pain. The problem is the availability of these opioids was just too much, too plentiful, and people became and they're also just easily addictive. So people became addicted to them, and when we asked our doctors to prescribe more judiciously, make less available for a shorter amount of time, many people had trouble stopping the craving.
Right.
And turned to heroin as a very cheap and available substitute. So now we've got this problem of so many people, and we've got the epicenters in Staten Island and the South Bronx, but really no community is immune from this. Folks who just can't manage addictive process that was begun very much because of prescribing patterns.
And I have this theory, and you may disagree with me, but I have this theory that the opioid problem nationally, and folks who were being hit hard and families that were being hit hard, affected the way people thought about the campaign. Even though it wasn't really mentioned, even though Hillary Clinton was the only one of the candidates who actually put forth a plan, that part of the fear of the last election and part of the fear that people had in the last election was connected to drug abuse in their communities and the pain that they've seen and the behavior that they've seen as a result of opioid abuse. I think it was the big secret of the election. This issue was not nearly high enough on the radar screen. You have any thoughts about that?
Well, yeah, I think that first of all, I think everything is connected, and that so many people who are in professions that were dealing with manufacturing or manual labor just were affected by this. I mean, doctors prescribed these medications for back pain and for all different kinds of conditions that came out of the professions that they were in. And then when they were hurt and then suffering from addiction, they were kind of neglected, totally abandoned. And no one was talking to them. No one was talking to this population of people who had worked so hard and then was kind of left by the wayside.
I remember when crack hit New York and across the country, there was so much attention. Now, some bad policy came out of the crack epidemic, but but there was a tension. There was a sort of a riveted attention on it, and you couldn't get away from 60 Minutes or any TV news or the media in terms of this is crack. The opioid problem doesn't seem to have gotten that kind of attention.
That's right.
And it's all very human, and it's all very personal, and it needs to be talked about. And you talked on this show about a year ago about the stigma factor and shame in mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think we've made some progress in terms of people getting help or looking for help, or is stigma still a big issue?
Stigma is a very big issue. And I think that the difference between the crack epidemic and I mean, there are many differences, but the difference between the crack and heroin epidemics is that the violence was a much bigger factor with crack. And there's always the intersection between public health and public safety.
Right.
When you have drugs, we're really striving to take the public health approach and help people understand that addiction is a disease, just like asthma or diabetes. It's a chronic disease. It takes time for people to get well. This is something we have to talk about. We have to educate people about. For too long, people have seen it as a matter of character. Like, people just lack discipline. They just can't say no because it's more invisible than someone not being able to breathe or,
right,
you know, having an attack because have a heart disorder or something. They just don't see it the same way. But it really is a disease that has to be treated. We need more resources to treat people on an outpatient basis because, people have to be able to go on with their lives, hold their heads up high with the understanding that as devastating as it is to be addicted to a drug, that it is treatable.
Right, right, right. Absolutely. And listen, thank you very much for being on the show to talk about this and to talk about Healing NYC. I hope you will come back again. It's always a pleasure to talk to you and to talk about the good work that's being done in the city of New York.
Oh, thank you so much, Chris. And I want everyone who's listening to know that all they have to do, if they want to find a pharmacy that distributes naloxone, or if they want help for their addiction or any mental health problem or substance use disorder, they can call 1-888-NYC-WELL. It's free and it's confidential.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's about all the time we have for today. I want to thank our guests, John Nichols, the nation's national affairs correspondent, and New York City First Lady Shirlane McRae. Before we go, a few announcements. Senator Chuck Schumer says he will lead a filibuster of President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Judge Neil Gorsuch, who we just talked about. You can support this effort by calling the U.S. Senate at 202-224-3121. This November, vote no on the ballot question regarding the state constitutional convention and protect our bargaining rights, pensions, and benefits. For more information, you can go to our website at dc37.net. The DC 37 Disability Committee holds a forum on accessoride services on Monday, April 3rd at 6 p.m. at Union Headquarters. And you can learn more about purchasing your first home by attending a seminar on Thursday, April 6th at 5:30 p.m. at Union Headquarters. To pre-register, call 212-815-1814. Stay in touch with us at State of the Union at dc37.net. You can follow us on Twitter. You can follow us on Facebook. The producer of this show is Rudy Orozco. The sound engineer is Andrea Minocchio. I'm Chris Policano. Until next time, ciao.